I would like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Barbara M. from the Hilltop Group in York, Pennsylvania.
That's awesome. I'm Barb Miller. I'm an alcoholic. I was telling her, I'm like, oh, you have a clock and a place to put your water? You guys have it together over here. But my sobriety date is June 2nd of 1998. The group I belong to is the Hilltop Group. We meet Tuesdays and Fridays in York at 7 p.m. And all are welcome if you're in the area. I have a sponsor. She knows that she sponsors me. Definitely. In fact, I was dreaming I was calling her last night because I was resentful at my cousin in my sleep. So anyway, it was after I helped her give birth to her baby. You know how that goes in dreams. So, but yeah, I'm like calling her and I'm like, oh shoot, she's at work. And then I woke up and I'm like, oh, that was weird. But so anyway, I have a sponsor. I love my sponsor. And then I've had the, I think it's an honor to be able to help other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, with, you know, like that, you know, I have that inflow, you know, I have someone I can talk to, and then that outflow is, you know, helping others and, you know, being useful. Because I didn't think when I got here or, you know, the first 30 years of my life that I had any kind of use or purpose or anything, so... That's pretty good to be able to come to AA of all places and feel like you fit in and you can be useful, and it's good stuff. And I want to thank Emily for taking the trip with me tonight. We laughed so hard. You know, that's one of the things that's so great, you know, because I was so serious when I got sober, you know. Like, I'd walk into a meeting, nobody would sit next to me, and I'd be thinking, those bastards aren't giving me a chance, and just so much stuff going on in my head, and it was almost like, you know, the ride here was almost like a, but it wasn't, I didn't, you know, we didn't set out for it to be that way, but it almost felt like a gratitude trip to Quakertown, because I was just thinking about, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was depleted, I was, you know, I was morally, you know, bankrupt and whatever. I was just, you know, I wanted to be dead again and all that stuff, and my life has changed so much. And I always say, like, my life doesn't look the same. It doesn't smell the same. It doesn't feel the same. You know, and thank God for that. You know, I'm so, so grateful for what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for someone like me. And I'm a real believer. You know, I have a lot of enthusiasm for AA and the 12 steps and trusting God. And, it's, you know, and when I got to AA this time, you know, it wasn't the first time I had gotten to AA. I'd gotten to AA... maybe 11, 12 years previous to that, you know, and I tried AA, you know, every which way, partially every which way, and, you know, and you know, and, like, I remember when I first got to AA, I felt like I found my people, but if I'm not, you know, doing what we're taught to do here, which is trust God, clean house, and help others, you know, all of a sudden you guys are like, you know, strangers to me too. So anyway, I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I was born in New Jersey. I came from a family that drank hard, and they played hard, worked hard, you know, played hard. I think I said that backwards. But anyway, it was not uncommon to, you know, see parties at my grandparents' house, you know, all the time. My grandfather was a politician. Me and my brothers and my mom, sometimes my dad, lived above my grandparents, and my grandfather was a politician, so he had parties, you know. My mom, not an alcoholic. My dad is not an alcoholic. And I don't know how that can be, but it is. You know, neither of them are alcoholic, or my dad's, he's passed. It was 9 years this week. But, you know, they didn't have that ism that I had, that, you know, that twist and everything that we have, and, you know, as alcoholics. But my mom would tell us kids, she'd say, hey, you know, there was a party in the rec room last night. Don't go down there. And as soon as my mom went into the other room, me and my brother, that is also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, we would hightail our butts down to the rec room. And my older brother, he's not one of us, and he would listen and behave, and he wouldn't do that. And, you know, he's weird. And me and Dave, we'd go down there, and, you know, we'd eat stale Fritos and drink half empties or half folds, whatever, however you want to look at it. And... you know, maybe there's a body, you know, a body in the backyard under a picnic table or floating in the pool alive, and that's just, that was how it went. And, you know, I didn't know what alcohol did. I didn't feel the effects of alcohol that day. First things I remember about me, I was telling Emily, it's like, you know, some people say to go over this line and all that stuff. I said, you know, I feel like I came out of my mom's womb just, you know, punching and screaming, and I was just waiting to pour booze on me. I don't remember ever be like having this wonderful thought life, you know. I just don't. I was like paranoid from the, you know, as soon as I jumped out of her womb, I was worried about what you're thinking. You know, I was a little blonde hair, blue-eyed girl that was young enough to play on a swing set, but old enough to hide my Marlboros up the leg of the swing set, you know. You know, I was just like, that's what I always say, I was just waiting to pour booze on me. That's the only way I can describe it. I'd steal stuff just because I could, and, you know, and I'd do these kind of things, and I didn't feel bad. The only time I ever really felt bad is if maybe I would get told on, like if you told my mom, you know, but I didn't really care that I took stuff from people or stole from the deli or smoked at age 5, you know, I didn't care. So I lived in New Jersey till I was about 8. My mom met my stepdad, and that's how I got to Pennsylvania the first time. And I went from being able to see the Twin Towers go up from the end of my road to living in like no man's, sort of like around here, you know, like no man's land. And it was beautiful, but when you have an active brain, you know, it's like really hard. And that's how I was. I was just so, I was like, oh my God, what did we get into? You know, our closest neighbors had no electricity, and, you know, it was like a little different than North Jersey. And that's when I remember feeling really like isolated and alone and, you know, kind of just stuck to myself, you know, like didn't have friends, and it just seemed like life really stunk, you know. When I was 13, I had the drink that made sense. I had this great Aunt Harriet. She was probably like 2 feet shorter than me, and she never got married. She cursed a lot. Everybody was always fighting with her. She wore wigs. She thought she was reincarnated. Rumor had it she had a child and placed it up for adoption. I love this woman, and I don't know why, but like when she, I just loved her. And when she died, she had letters from me in her purse, you know. And this day, she told me we were going to hitchhike to the mall. So me and Aunt Harriet, you know, we got out on the road and stuck our thumbs out, and some old man picked us up, and we went to the mall, hitchhiked home, and I guess our reward for our hard work that day was a couple drinks. And I went into the kitchen, and she pulled out 2 glasses and filled them full, and I think it was wine. And I always say I think that was the last time I ever had wine, but I like to drink stuff that was got you there really quick. But she, you know, poured these drinks, and I remember her going back into the dining room to the family, and I remember drinking that cup down. I remember filling it up, drinking it again, and I finally knew what they had been doing in the rec room all those years, you know. Now I understood what alcohol really could do for a person, and I was excited about it, and I don't know how long it was, but, you know, I was sitting in the dining room, and I definitely could feel the effects of alcohol, and I knew that I probably shouldn't let anybody at the table know that I could feel the effects of alcohol. And right away, like a good granddaughter, you know, I stole whatever booze I could find in my grandmother's home, which there was a lot, you know, because my grandfather had passed away years ago, and there was so much booze in her house, and she didn't really drink, so I would just steal her stuff and bring it home, and me and my little friends, you know, that was our, you know, relief, you know, and I'd camp out with my girlfriends, and we'd drink, and, you know, my mom... That was, you know, and I really believe that this is one of the reasons why I got to AA and my brother got to AA so young, is my mom was in Al-Anon. She joined Al-Anon family groups back in, like, the 70s. And, like, when she goes on vacation, she goes away with her church ladies. Those are her Al-Anon ladies. And, you know, she made good relationships with them, and she started practicing principles in her life. And she would say all this positive stuff to her, to us, and I'd be like, ugh, get away. And then when I hit 30, I'm like, oh, I wish I would have listened to her. But, you know, my mom was Susie Positive and, you know, doing what she does. And And so that's how I kind of found out that, like, there's something there for alcoholism. I learned about the disease concept, you know, and all that stuff. And with all that knowledge, you know, if I'm going to become an alcoholic, I'm going to become an alcoholic. There's no stopping it. And what happened was, you know, I'd drink when I could, and I remember a couple of times going back into the bushes looking for empty bottles to see if I can get an extra swig out of it and wondering, like, you know, something going on with me. And, you know, and I was just a mess. You know, I was always thinking about the next drink at that, even at that young age. And when I was 16, the good little Catholic girl that I was, I came home and announced to my mother that I was 7.5 months pregnant, and I just found out that day. You know, you ever see that show? You know, I didn't know I was pregnant. And I wound off. My mom, all her Al-Anon principles kicked in. She took me under her wing. I went off to a maternity home. I was scared to death. Scariest time in my life, and that's where I kind of like found a new kind of God concept, you know. An ex-nun was running the place, and she took me under her wing also and kind of taught me about a God that could be loving and kind and all those things. And you know, I was only there a couple of months, and I had this baby, and, you know, and I decided I was going to put her up for adoption. And I believe that I did that because I thought that's what my family would want me to do. And I'm not saying it's their fault, but I would always, like, figure stuff. I never said, hey, Mom, what do you think I should do? You know, like, I got it, you know. I always took care of everything. I did not need anybody's help with anything, right? So I put this little girl up for adoption. And it was almost as if I was like, hey, see you in 20 years, God. I got it. Whew, thank God I got through that. And that would be the thing that I drank about, you know, for years. You know, it was her birthday. It was my birthday. It was Mother's Day, Father's Day. I saw a baby girl, whatever. I always drank at the fact that. So it was a big deal to me. You know, that was like a life-changing thing, having to, in my head, put this baby up for adoption. And I cried many a tear and drank a lot of booze to try to numb that. And that's just how that went, you know. And I blamed that on why I drank so much, not that I was alcoholic. So I, you know, decided that because I put this baby up for adoption that I was going to do something with my life. You know, I envisioned, you know, having a career and having about, you know, 7 kids and a white picket fence and, you know, everything was going to be cool. And, you know, and life was just not easy for me. I moved out of my mom's house when I was about a day after I graduated high school. My brother Mark was coming back from the Marines, and he needed a roommate, and I thought, wow, I could be a roommate for him. I'd be perfect. You know, Mr. Responsibility over here. And I moved in with him, and, you know, and it just was like, it's like constant parties all the time. Walking into the apartment, and there's like wall-to-wall bodies, and drinking out of bottles of beer that have cigarette butts in the bottom, and, you know, and it was a blur. And I was, you know, I was going to make something of my life. And, you know, I was going to go into the military. My brother had been in the military. My stepfather, you know, maybe I'll take that course too. And, you know, and I couldn't get into the military. And this is a perfect example of step one for me. You know, I decide I'm going to go. And they tell me to show up in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. We get there, they're like, hooray, tomorrow's the, you know, the beginning of your new life, your career, you know, whoopee. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to make something of myself. And they tell us to go to our rooms, and I have to share this room with this girl that I don't know. You know, the hotel rooms have, like, 2 big beds, and they kind of, like, go to sleep, and tomorrow, you know, everything's going to begin. Your life is going to be new. And, you know, your future is at your fingertips, kind of blah, 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 right? And so I go to my room, trying to say hi to this girl. I put my suitcase down, and it occurs to me that when I walked into the hotel, there was a bar. And I thought, well, maybe I could just go find somebody to hang out with for a little while. And what happens is, you know, I find somebody, and we get smashed, and I invite him and a couple other people back to the room while this do-gooder is sleeping in her bed. And, you know, and I go the next morning. I haven't slept. I fail the physical. They give me another chance. So in 2 weeks later, I get there. They're like, okay, this is your room. Tomorrow's the beginning of your career. This is great. Go to bed. We'll see you in the morning. And I'm like, yes, I'm going to do this right this time. And I go to my room, put down my suitcase, and it occurs to me that there was a lobby down there, and maybe I can, and that's what happens. And for years, I'm thinking, like, I didn't get into the military because I couldn't duck walk. Well, no, I was plastered both times. And even the military doesn't like that, you know. Well, I'm not saying the military's bad or anything, but a lot of people drink. But anyway, and then I tried to get into nursing school, and I got into this really good nursing school, and I didn't show up. And that's like the story of my life, you know. Constantly making these big decisions with nobody's help, you know, relying on self. And I started to get really paranoid, and, and by the end of, like, just before I turned 20, you know, and just those, like, 3.5 years or whatever, you know, my world became really small, and it became, like, you know, like, gross. It was dirty, and I just felt like, you know, everybody was out to get me, and I hated everyone. And, you know, when I'm drinking or I'm untreated, you know, this is sort of how my brain goes. Like, my thoughts, they can start off really good. Like, you know, like, oh, I'm sorry. And then they could go, like, but if you weren't such a jerk, I wouldn't have done that, you know. Like, it starts off good, and then it makes no sense. And this is sort of what happened was I'm living with my brother Mark. I don't know whether the rent's been paid or not. Not very good roommate. I invite people over that steal his Pink Floyd collection of whatever. Like, oh, big deal, right? I'm hanging out. I know. I'm hanging out with his friends and starting to feel like I just need to, like, you know, change towns or something. And that's what happens is I just move. I get in my Volare and I head to New Jersey. And this car, like, the thermostat, like, this is really bad because I've been driving it like this way for like 2 years. The thermostat's broken. So I have to drive with the heat on in the summer to make the car not overheat, and it's bad. So anyway, so I write this note, you know, because a couple years earlier, I felt like I had arrived. I finally had friends. I was no longer, like, you know, scared of the world. So now I have all these best friends, and we go on trips to the beach, and now I'm like, you know, everybody hates me. I think I'll eat worms. So I write this note, like, you know, I'm sorry, but I need to get out of here, and I'm, you know, if you guys weren't such jerks, I wouldn't be leaving, kind of thing. And I get in my car and I leave, and they have no clue where I am. I'm like almost 20 years old, and I go to New Jersey. I wind up at the doorstep of a father I hadn't seen in years, and he's like, "My home, my house is your house. Come on in," you know, and I'm building this relationship with my father, and I never really. I mean, I had a relationship with him, but I thought this was a great opportunity to live under the same roof with him and whatever, and I'm starting to feel really squirrely because I don't have enough booze, and I'm trying to hide the way I really am because I'm like, who's going to like me, you know, the way I am? And I remember saying to my stepmom, you know, I feel like I'm going crazy. And she said, well, why don't you go to a psychologist? And I was like, yeah, maybe that's what I need. And what was going on, truthfully, was that I wasn't getting the amount of booze in my system that I needed, and I was getting restless, irritable, and discontented. And I went to see this lady, Shirley Lipschitz. She was in Lakewood, New Jersey, and I'll never forget her name. But it's like one of those names I can't forget. And I show up to this woman. And somewhere along the line, she knew what alcoholism was. And I don't know that I'd been drinking that morning, but she pulled out the pamphlets and she started asking me the questions. Do you drink before noon? And I'm like, well, I got this one. If you're still up from the night before, you know, it doesn't count. Only if I'm still up from the night before, you know. But anyway, she said, you know, maybe it would be a good idea if I tried some AA meetings after her evaluation, and that's what I did. And I'd love to say that I, you know, went to AA and everything was great, but really, I went to AA, I found my people. Like, I got you guys, I could feel you, you know, like, nowhere else. I was saying to Emily on the way here, I mean, we say stuff to each other that, you know, maybe, like, my sister-in-law would be like, oh my, you know, we have that language of the heart or whatever, you know. And so anyway, I go to my first meeting, and it's a women's meeting, and I walk in the door, and, you know, they look, I'm deer in the headlights, I'm sure, because I don't do well, like, sober, you know, I'm, like, scared and paranoid, and these women attack me, well, not attack me, they, like, love me, and they come up to me, and they hug me, and they welcome me, and tell me to go to a meeting, and this one lady in particular, her name was Maggie, you know, she told me to go to a meeting every day if I drank every day, and, you know, and this isn't stuff that is in the big book, but these were the suggestions she gave me, and she said, go to a meeting every day, get a sponsor, blah, 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 and, you know, and I think if she would not have, you know, reached out and talked to me and been so kind, I probably wouldn't have came back the next day. And that's the truth of the matter for me. And I think we all fit in for whatever reason. You know, certain sponsors and sponsees, I think we click because, you know, we're made for each other so that we can get sober. You know, different people in different walks of life or whatever. But this lady was awesome, and she didn't stay sober. I think she died within the year, you know, of an alcoholic suicide. And you never know how someone's going to affect you or how you're going to affect them or anything, you know. But anyway, so that was my first intro. The next meeting I went to was a speaker meeting, much like this. They shut off the lights. Speaker comes up to the front. And the thing that impressed me so much, not the fact that I had to walk past the greeters. That was deadly. Like, the people, hello, how are you? Oh, welcome. And it's like, ah, you know. But it's horrible. But it's bad. And so anyway, I get there, and the meeting's going on, and this person's speaking, and, you know, they're telling stories from the podium about how they drove their pickup truck through their neighbor's front window, and everybody's like, ah, ha, 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 and I'm like, wait, what's going on here, you know? And they weren't being cocky or, you know, like jerks. They were just like, somehow they were okay with all the nasty, dirty stuff they had done. And that was the first thing that got my attention, was like, oh, people can get okay with the stuff they've done. That's pretty cool. And so I got, you know, over the next 2 years, I got about, I don't know, about 15 sponsors. I remember my one sponsor had me doing steps, and I was supposed to be doing my inventory, and she had this other sponsee, Sue, who had just broken up with Bob, and I'm at this sober dance, and she sees me, you know, catch Bob's eye, and she's just like, Barb, do your inventory, stay away from Bob. And I thought, who the heck needs an inventory when there's this great specimen of a man? And he was like twice my age. He had a T-shirt on that said Captain Condom. And, yeah. So at 2 years sober, I needed a good step drink, you know? And that's what happened, you know? No real steps going on, you know? The shininess of AA was wearing off, because I wasn't doing anything but nothing, you know, fellowshipping. I was the girl that would walk into the meeting and empty the contents of my pocketbook on the table, and things would scatter everywhere. You know, I was just really nutty, and I'd chew like a 10-pack of gum over the course of an hour. And nobody said, hey, crazy girl, get out of AA, you know, and that's awesome. It's the only place we don't get kicked out, I think. So, yeah, so what happened was I wound up drinking. I came out of a blackout in Florida with a pocket full of cash. Like, I stole somebody's money. And you know, and there I am. Like, I guess I'm not too young to be alcoholic. And I made it back to New Jersey. I stayed sober maybe 4 more years. And when I say I stay sober, I really mean I stayed sober. There was like no God, you know, unless you were talking about God, then I'd be like, oh yeah, I love God too. And if you were saying there is no God, I'd be like, yeah, there's no God. You know, I was just clueless. So what happens is I moved back to Pennsylvania because now, you know, I get to New Jersey because Pennsylvania was a problem. And then I get to New Jersey and New Jersey's a problem. And this can happen, like cold, you know, sober is can be. You know, it did for me. I had no steps, no God. I hated everyone. And, you know, and I just ran and ran and ran. You know, I was like so obsessive and compulsive. And not present. And I remember this one time I was still dating Bob, and or whatever, I don't even know what we were doing. We lived together with no heat. And, you know, that's how good it gets for me. No heat. We have all our clothes on top of us in the winter just to stay warm. And I'm sober, and if you want what I have, you know. And and I remember I was getting, like, sick of Bob, so I went over to the sober club. And my friend said, "Hey, Barb, what are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, I don't know." And they said, "Well, you want to go to Arizona?" And I'm like, "Sure." And then I was like, "Well, when are you leaving?" And they're like, "In an hour." So I didn't even tell Bob. I just get in my car. I go home. I fill up a plastic bag full of clothes. Go to Arizona for a few weeks, you know. It was, like, horrible. But anyway, that's sort of how I live. I like sparkly things. I'd love to see Atlantic City on the horizon or anything, just anything to get out of myself. So I moved back to Pennsylvania, and I spend 4 good hard years, you know, miserable. And I bump into some people in Dover, Pennsylvania. And, you know, and me and my brother. Now, my brother, he had gotten sober. I mean, I'd gotten sober, and then he got sober. And then I drank, and he drank, and he got... And somehow he's, like, 6 years sober ahead of me, right? Well, not yet, because I'm still sober at this point. But anyway, we met these people. Me and my brother would go over to their house. And, you know, the woman talked about having untreated alcoholism. She was telling me how you can be in the rooms of AA and not really doing the things that are suggested to have, you know, permanent, happy, joyous-free sobriety, and you could just be, like, you know, crazy and feel suicidal and all that stuff. And that was pretty much me, you know. I was just, like, sobriety was not better than drinking to me, you know, because then I could feel every scream and inch of everything that was going on in my life. So I was pretty miserable and suicidal and all that stuff. And somewhere along the line, you know, I learned that. I did not know that. I had no clue. I was like, oh, you know. And then I went and drank, and I went into the psych unit, and I remember, you know, seeing what, like, was going on in my brother's life. Like, and I never thought that my brother would be my example or the person that showed me that there was something better than what I was doing. But my brother would often say that, you know, from the podium, that he wasn't wired right from the factory. And here's this guy, right? I come from the same exact factory he does. And he's, like, getting happy. I'm seeing him, like, he has a job. He has his own apartment. Not that, you know, sobriety just, like, you know, that's what comes with sobriety. But, you know, I think for the most part, things get better when we get sober. You know, I know for me that my life is beyond my wildest dreams. I would have never seen my life the way it is now, you know, when I first got here. And he had some good stuff going on in his life. He was helping other alcoholics. I'd go over to his apartment to have coffee with him, and he'd be making financial amends on the phone to his creditors, you know, and I thought that was kind of weird. Like, why worry about it now? You know, I'd get credit cards from the bank that I worked at, and I'd, you know, oh, it doesn't work anymore. Can I get another one? You know, I never thought about giving any money back, but, I saw what was going on in my brother's life, and you know, and I just thought, well, you know, maybe I don't have to die, you know. Maybe this AA thing works, you know. Because somewhere along the line, I thought that, you know, you come to AA, you hug the crap out of each other, you know, and you go home and you kick the dog and you yell at the wife or the husband or, you know, if you want to steal from your grandmother. I'm not saying I did. Well, yeah, I did. I can't lie here, but whatever, you know, steal from anybody. I didn't realize that, like, you don't just act like an AAer for an hour, you know. But then I saw what was going on with Dave. I'd go into family situations. My mom would say something. He would respond sanely and respectably, and I'd be like, "Did you hear what she said?" You know, like, I was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. I had no spiritual tools at my feet, you know. While they were there, they were covered in a bunch of stuff. I couldn't find them. But and Dave is, like, going into family situations, and I see this tremendous change in him, and I know that AA must work, and something's going on here, and maybe it can. And what I do know about myself is that I'd been around up until this point. I'd been around AA for about 12 years. I'd been sober most of that time, kinda, and nothing was happening for me. And I know that I'd never tried AA the way, you know, it's written in the big book. I'd never tried it the way my brother was doing it. And you know, what do I have to lose? So in the middle of writing my suicide note, you know, and, you know, my sort of my, like, you know, life sucks, so I'm killing myself. If you guys would have been nicer, I wouldn't have done this kind of, you know, how that head goes. And I just got on my knees and I just prayed for God to help me, you know, and to put somebody in my life that could help me the way my brother was being helped. And you know, and a lot of things happened in the beginning that I felt like were real not coincidences. And that had happened when I was 19. Like, little things would happen. I'd get this idea that maybe there is this higher power out there that's guiding me. And it was, I felt it real strong now. And, you know, and I asked this woman to sponsor me. And I'll tell you what, she is awesome. And she moved away. And I think she's living in Oklahoma now. And I appreciate a lot of what she taught me way more now than I did, like, my first 5 or 10 years of sobriety, and that's okay. But she was awesome. She got me into the big book. You know, she was one of those women that, you know, was able to give a lot of time to Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't let the things that AA gave her, you know, get in the way of AA. She was awesome, and she was my hero. She really was, and she got me into that book, and we went page by page, and, you know, and I heard AA in a way that I'd never heard it before. I was like, holy mackerel. Like, wait, when did they put the steps in the big book? Aren't we supposed to use that other one? And she did use the other one, too. But, you know, I learned some stuff that was, like, mind. It was just awesome. And, you know, she taught me about, you know, the threefold disease. It's physical, it's mental, it's spiritual. You know, I finally understood that it wasn't the church of my understanding that had screwed me up. It was my alcoholism that screwed me up. That, you know, I had to change my ideas about God, you know, if I was going to stay sober. I could get with what with what Bill says in his story, you know, and I kind of had to take God that way in the beginning. Great creator, and I would rewrite the third and seventh step prayers and take out all the V's and thou's and the, you know, and the Lord's Prayer, and then I realized that it's about what it means, it's not how it's said, and then I could get with it. But, you know, and I learned to say those prayers from the very beginning. I remember when she went to say the third step prayer with me on knees with her. I was like, oh, great, see, now I know why she's so available. She's probably going to try to kiss me or something. This is what you're dealing with when I get sober. And I was like, oh, great. Miss AA is going to plant one on me, but it's not what happened. You know, I just, you know, my thinking wasn't right. And she was awesome. She's great. And she, you know, met with me regularly, and we went through those steps, and I saw AA in a way that I had never seen it before. And I remember when I was going through the, you know, making amends and stuff, I'd show up to meetings, and I'd be balking on a certain amends, and I'd hear something from the podium exactly like, you know, what I was balking about, and I'd be like, oh, my gosh, you know, like, God is showing me in obvious ways, you know. And it became a really nice trip for me. You know, sure, I have something to look back on. I didn't do AA, and I was really miserable, and then I did do it, and my life just, like, opened up. My life is nothing like I would have, like I said, I was going to, like, go into the military, and then I was going to become a nurse, and I was going to get married and have the white picket fence and a million kids, and my life isn't like that at all. The things that I thought that I wanted or needed, you know, just didn't happen the way I thought they should, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I see how my life is in the last 15 years. Even before that, has unfolded in exactly the way it was supposed to, you know, just in a way that I would be able to deal with it and use that experience to be useful to other alcoholics. That child that I drank at for years, you know, I remember, you know, doing inventories and just not getting anywhere, you know, and when I got sober this time, You know, I got neutral. I was okay with the fact that I put this child up for adoption, and, you know, and I was just trusting God that everything happens the way it's supposed to. And when I was about, I don't know, it was probably the first 5 years of my sobriety, some lady in AA was pregnant, and she got out of jail, and she needed somewhere to stay, and I just happened to have an extra room in my apartment, and she came and stayed with me, and, you know, she's 42 and pregnant, and things weren't looking good for her. And I remember she said to me one morning, she's like, "Barbara, I think I'm going to put this baby up for adoption." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I've been through that. If you ever have any questions or whatever, you know, I'm not a professional on adoption or anything, but all I have is my experience." And she started to talk to me about that. And I don't know what people need to do in that situation. I think it could be hard, anything. You know, it's just a hard decision in general. But I told her that I'd go along with her, and we went to interview prospective parents for her. And it was so weird because she went to the same exact place that I went to in Harrisburg. And I didn't tell her where I went. But we got in the car, and I'm like, "Oh, my gosh, this is where I put my daughter up for adoption." And I got in there, and, you know, the caseworker is still there that I used back when. And we interviewed a couple of couples. And when we were leaving, I said to the lady, I said, "Hey, Stacy, you know, what would you do in my position? You know, like, just, you know, what do you think I should do?" And she said, "Write your daughter another letter. It's about time you put another letter in there." Now, this is what I did. You know, when I was drinking, when I relapsed, I had all these albums of letters and photographs and all this stuff from when my daughter was a baby, the first 5 years of her life, from the adoptive family. And when I drank and I blacked out and woke up in Florida, I bumped into some folks at the diner, and they said, "Barb, you've got to come get those picture albums of your daughter with the letters and stuff, because we're moving. You got to come get them. We have them out by the garbage can." Everything in me wanted to go get them right now. That was like the thing. You know, this is my daughter. I loved her. I was going to make something of my life because I put her up for adoption and blah, blah, blah. And I never went and got them. So I had a lot of shame and all that stuff that goes along with the way we are. And then I got okay with all that. And then I'm presented with the situation. And I'm there at this office. And they tell me to put a letter in her file. And, you know, a couple of months go by. And, you know, I'm feeling really compelled to send this letter. So I write a couple of letters. I run them by my grand sponsor. And I send it to this place. And about a week later, I'm driving up to Boston for a conference, and my phone rings, and it's this place. And they said, "Barbara, you're never going to believe this, but your daughter's adopted father asked if he got the letter the day after he called us, the day after he got the letter, and he asked us if you're interested in, you know, meeting up with your daughter or whatever." So it was crazy how the timing, you know, of that letter got there right as they were calling the next day. And then one thing led to another. And, you know, I met my daughter like maybe 6-9 months later. It's funny, too, because like AOL and chat rooms and all this stuff. So this someone kept trying to instant message me, right? And it's like, Ball 87. I'm like, "Ooh, pervert, ignore, right?" Then I find out it's my daughter's like jersey number, and she plays ball, and I'm like, "Oh my God." But you know, I see that like God is so big, and if he wants something to happen, it happens. And I don't quite understand how that happens, but I would have shortchanged myself, you know, because I was so happy that I could use that experience about my daughter with this woman. And, you know, I'll shortchange myself. I think that that's the end of the story. And that's how my sobriety has been. You know, it is just like this, I don't know, colorful journey, you know. And it's been about, you know, I thought it was, you know, about quitting drinking when I got here. But really, you know, it goes way further than that. You know, I didn't know how to deal with life. And that's why I drank, you know, coupled with the fact that I had that physical allergy. But, you know, I didn't know how to deal with life. My life was falling apart, and I get to AA, and, you know, I'm just amazed at what happens here. You know, I really am. I was so lost. And AA has given me answers to all my problems and in all areas of my life. You know, I never thought I was going to get married. I married a guy in AA, and it was fun, you know. He did his thing, I did my thing. We met up somewhere in between. You know, we sponsored a lot of people. We were very excited about AA, and you don't know what's going to happen. I learned from every experience, but he winds up having a heart attack at, you know, age 42, and his things get ugly for him, and he winds up relapsing, and I wind up staying sober, and it was just a point in my life where I just changed sponsorship, and for some reason, you know, I was able to stay on this path and just try to trust God, and I don't know how that happened. I almost felt like, you know, everything was put in place so I could stay and help people, and that was devastating to me. I remember sitting in meetings crying, snot bubbles, and nobody said, hey, cuckoo, get out of here, you know. They just, AA's loved me through everything, and I try to be the same way, and my husband I have today, he's great. Did not pick him. He is not alcoholic. I would have never said, hey, you, let's go out on a date. And my husband, he's like principled. Like, he does stuff because he's nice. He doesn't have to be like, let me go help someone so I can stay sober. He's like doing it. And I'm like, why are you digging out 50 cars in the neighborhood? Screw them. You know, no, he's just a very nice person. When he says something, he means what he's saying. You know, it's not like I have to, you know, because I'd be like, what do you mean by that? You know, this guy would not fight with me if I paid him to. And I'm really grateful for that. He's a good person. And that's great. And, you know, we don't have children. You know, I had a bunch of miscarriages and never had any more kids beyond my daughter. And that's okay. And that was another time in my sobriety that was really dark. And, you know, and I walked through it and learned and growed. You know, I grew and being able to sponsor women. You know, I just look at my sobriety and I just see when things are the toughest, which, you know, it's kind of hard for it to be tough when there's God. Like, you can have God and walk through stuff, I guess. It's comforting for me, you know. In the past, that would have driven me crazy. I don't know. It would have been a reservation. But, you know, I think with AA, I'm given tools to walk through all kinds of situations that, you know, probably would have, you know, put me over the edge had I not gone through the steps and helped others and all that stuff. And when I moved to Middletown, my husband happened to have this job for 25 years in a row. I'm like I was telling Emily, when I first met my in-laws, my husband says, you should see all the jobs Barb had. She pulled out a notebook and she filled up both sides and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, my thing is like, oh my gosh, don't let them know how horrible I am. And he would never do anything like that to make me look horrible. He's like, nobody's going to hate you because of how many jobs you had. And I'm like, oh, that's right. But anyway, so I decided to move closer to his job. And I get to Middletown, Pennsylvania, and this is like what I'm talking about. It's like I just feel like when I stay willing and open to what, you know, God has in store for me or whatever, you know, things, I just seem to be kept on the path. You know, it's almost like I start to veer off and I get pulled by the back of my shirt and put back on the path. And I move there and I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, I've been through a lot, and, you know, maybe I could make friends with the neighbors and drink beer and, you know, be principled, you know. And right away I'm like, whoa, warning, Will Rogers. And I go to a meeting in a town. I don't know anybody, and I show up and I share that, and we're like, ah, ha, 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 you know, everybody's laughing. And some girl, some sick woman, comes up to me after the meeting and asks me to sponsor. She said she just got out of rehab. And I felt like that woman helped, you know, keep me right where I needed to be. And we, you know, it wasn't on my bucket list to meet someone who dies sober, but this woman wound up getting colon cancer, and she died like a 2 years sober. And I got to see AA from an angle that I didn't necessarily ever see it from before. And, you know, this woman was more willing than anyone. She was the most kindest sponsee, sorry, Emily, but one of the most kindest sponsees I've ever had, you know. And she just was awesome, and she'd invite you over, and she'd bake you a cake. And she's dying of cancer. She's got stage 4 cancer. and she was going through the steps and balking at amends, but doing them anyway. And I got to see how AA, you know, took this broken woman that, you know, was, you know, like having it really bad, you know, and her family is around her when she's dying. And she had made amends to everybody, and her side of the street was clean, and, you know, and they didn't have to be bothered with the questions. You know, she would come to me with the questions when she'd see stuff or things would happen, you know, when she was close to death. And it was pretty powerful, you know, and that family absolutely loves Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because of, you know, anybody could have sponsored her. You know, I think that, I'm not saying I did anything spectacular, but I'm saying that AA was really attractive to this family, and I think that, you know, they're going to know where to go if anybody in that family needs the hand of AA. And it was like one of the most powerful things I ever experienced. And, you know, I stayed in Middletown just long enough to do that, and we moved back to York. And I always say that York is like the AA capital of the world, because we have so many recovery houses and sober houses and this and that and the other thing, and it's, you know, AA is alive and well, and I love it, you know, and I really do. And there's all kinds of different people in York, and it's just a great place to be in AA. I've made some really awesome friendships. I've been able to go on some awesome road trips. Love road trips, even to this day. And, you know, and been able to visit places, go on amends trips, and, you know, and build long-term relationships with people. You know, people tell me that, like, they talk to their high school best friend from kindergarten. I'm like, what? Like, that is crazy. Why? You know, and now I'm starting to see, like, what that's like to have people in your life, to see sponsees, you know, get to you, and they're like, desperate and dying, and to see them grow up and get married and have kids and sponsor people. And it's amazing, you know. And I wish everybody could see, like, how awesome this thing is. Like, we do not have to be people that are, you know, laying in the gutter anymore. You know, we can have lives beyond our wildest dreams. And I'm not saying, when I'd love to win the lottery, but I don't think I'm healthy enough to do that. But, you know, my life is exactly the way it ought to be, right here, right now. And I know that without a doubt, you know. And I get to learn so much as I, you know, go along. And it's funny because I don't know why I would even use the word perfect, but I'm not ever going to be perfect. And I am very aware about how imperfect I am. But, you know, somewhere along the line, I realized that I don't need to be perfect to do this. You know, I just need to be useful. I just need to be willing. I just need to show up and, you know, stop staring at myself and let go of that self-centeredness and that fear. And, you know, and it kind of, like, everything changes, you know. I went, like, you know, from a journey from my head to my heart, you know. And the biggest lessons I've learned was, you know, just showing up here and moving my feet and doing things that, you know, people had been doing in AA for years, you know, and stop being like, I got it, you know, because that was my entire life. I got it. I'd walk into the wall, back up, smash my head again, back up, you know, I got it. And AA allows me to, you know, have a life like, you know, it's we, not Barb, it's we. And it goes a lot better that way. And I've, you know, and I've been blessed to be able to walk through all kinds of situations, you know, just walking through them sober, you know, regaining the relationships with my family at a totally different level, you know, seeing people in my family die, you know, when I lost my father and my nephew within just a few weeks of each other, and I got to see how, you know, the things I learned in AA put me in a position to be useful to my family, you know. And, you know, and I, when I get here, it is all about me. You know, my father died, my nephew died, you know. That's not what AA does for me. It allows me to be part of, to reach out to others, to be there for my brothers and sisters and, you know, all of that. And that's a good deal. You know, I'm truly blessed, and I hope that the enthusiasm that I have for AA never goes anywhere. I hope that I wake up every day hopeful. I hope that I remember in a meeting it's not about the pocketbook I have. You know, it's about people can die from this, and I need to show up and be available. And usually when I do that, things go a lot better than I, you know, would have anticipated. Always, you know? Always. And so, anyway, I'm grateful that Sarah asked me to come and share with you guys. And I'm going to shut up because it's almost time.